Okay, we're back for part two. That was for the benefit of the people listening on Ed Radio. Sorry. I actually did create a thing called Ed Radio, and it is the kind of fast, loose, no structure kind of thing that I love. It's what Ed Radio does. I'll talk about Ed Radio tomorrow if you're coming back, but basically it retrieves RSS feeds, scours them for links to MP3s, and assembles them into a playlist. So basically, you just click on Ed Radio. Ed Radio starts. It starts with a little introduction. Welcome to Ed Radio. I do my best announcer voice, a little open source background music, and then it just plays MP3 files from any of the RSS feeds that I've collected. You'd think that would be a really good idea, but there are not nearly enough MP3 feeds out there. But that was all an aside. Okay. And maybe a little plug for tomorrow. I don't know. I don't know what time it will be tomorrow, but it'll be sometime. Where was I? Okay. As I was writing the second part of this talk during the break, no, I'm kidding. but I did come up with the first line. If you bought, or at least you're kind of intrigued by the first part of this, I think you'll find the second part of this really interesting, because the first part of it is pretty negative. It's, you know, like, you can't do this, you can't do that, that won't work. The second part, which we'll get to after we finish with the first part, is more positive. So I'm going to zip through this last little bit of the first part. It's good stuff, but I still want to zip through it because I want to get to the good stuff. And actually, most of you are back. I'm so happy. Okay. Let's look at what we're doing now. I'm meeting with people from Education AU in a couple of weeks, and I meet with people. I had an argument with Dan Rehack from, I forget where he's from, but, you know, the ADL people in the United States, and learning objects and learning design. I've been arguing with everyone, Tom Carey and the people of Merlot, because, you know, there's all this talk about learning management systems and Blackboard. How many of you are familiar with Blackboard or WebCT? Yeah, there's a whole bunch of you. That's the thing, isn't it? And the new thing that's coming along, and it'll be in one of my talks sooner or later. If you follow on my website, you'll probably run into it. You know, the learning design, common systems, enterprise e-learning and all of that. Yeah. Let's look at it. Learning, as it exists today. And these are a bunch of things that I think are wrong. And they're wrong because of what we've just been talking about with the new digital generation, etc. Segregated from other activities. There is a day, and I think this day will come before my days are gone, when people will think, how odd that we went to a room to learn. I really do. I personally think that it's very odd. It's like reading, right? You know, imagine you had to go to a special room, we'll call it the reading room, in order to read. It's just strange, because if you want to read, you can read anywhere, right? Newspapers, you can get a newspaper on every street corner. There's writing on walls to play a video from the theater VCR. It tells you how to play the videos. It's reading right on the wall. Why do we have special rooms for learning? It's very strange. Synchronous. Time-based, limited. Now, we just had a plug. I was going to put your plug for networking in right here. A lot of the stuff they're doing with networking, I think they should do it because I think people should have the experience, but are based on these synchronous online learning systems. What was the one they're using for networking?
Illuminate,
right? Everything E and I and C and .com. I want to start a new trend. I want to R. Nobody's using R. I'm going to come up with a concept of R mail. it's a real kind of code on my website. It's called RMail. It doesn't work, but it's there. Pardon? That's right, iPatch. What's the date today? 16th? September 17th is, and this is true, Talk Like a Pirate Day. If you don't believe me, look it up on the web. September 17th, Talk Like a Pirate Day. I have to remember that for tomorrow. Synchronous time-based limiter. It's 2:30 in the morning where I live. If I was at home doing this talk, I'd be thinking synchronous is for, I don't know, geese. Because it makes no sense. Time-based, limited. I don't know if it's this slide or another slide. How many of you have worked with learning communities for your courses? All right. And your communities start when? When the course starts? And they end when the course ends? Some of them never end? Good. There's been a lot of work in learning communities, and they start up these learning communities, and then they end. Because the course ended. It's time-based, it's synchronous. Imagine if your town did that. The city of Canberra will cease to exist after October 30th. Nice knowing you. Strange. Learning. Certainly classes are like that. Classes begin, go for a period, and end. I've always thought of that as an odd concept, too. I mean, I took metaphysics. Who could tell? And the class ended. I wasn't finished. Fortunately, the topic of my paper was the unreality of time, which they threw back at me when I appealed. Learning offered in a structured, linear form. This is anathema to the new generation, isn't it? Structured, linear form. Why would you do that? Very strange. But nobody's changing, right? I mean, we know this. I've certainly talked about this for a long time. Many other people have talked. I mean, I'm not the only one who talks in this way. Jay Cross talks like this all the time. Seymour Papert talks like this. Whole body of that name drop for the rest of the session if you wanted. Has anyone stopped offering classes? Learning design, which is the big IMS thing, I can end my sentence, is all about organizing materials in a nice linear kind of fashion. Why? The comment for the microphone is that you've had people who have requested linear things. I've had requests for linear things. I was commenting during the break that my website used to be random and people complained. Which wasn't complete. It was never completely random. It's just none of the links worked. Okay. I have two ways of answering that. The good way and the cynical way. And I'll give you the good way first. I mean, that answer was actually kind of contained in your comment. Going non-linear doesn't mean the elimination of linear. I wandered around the city of Canberra yesterday, well, just the downtown area, because it's big, long highways everywhere you can't wander on, which was pretty random. I ended up going around in circles, but it was still linear. And I went from one place then another, and I actually asked people for some directions to get to places. In the middle of my randomness, I wanted to go somewhere, so I needed a path. That's okay. We don't throw out linear, but it just becomes part of a set of options. The cynical way And remember, everything's a conspiracy theory. Your students know what's up in your class. And what's up is, there is a linear progression of the material, and at the end of that is the exam. And they want to go from A to B, because what they want is to pass the exam. And the best way to get there is in a straight line. I don't know. Next time they ask them why. And then email me what they answer. I'd be curious to see that. It's a good comment, though. Last thing, predominantly content-based. This is the whole learning objects mantra. And one of the things, those of you who expected that I would actually be talking about quality, were probably expecting to hear, and this is true, is that in today's e-learning environment, there is an overemphasis on content, right? Learning objects, organizing courses, getting all of your content in, and that quality e-learning involves interaction or conversation as well as content. And of course, this is probably pretty much common knowledge by now, which is why it's probably not really part of the talk. But there is that sense, certainly in the e-learning models that are being developed, especially in the corporate community, in the military community, as designed by, I thought I'd throw something in military here because I haven't so far, such as ADL, which is very much the training manual, get the content out there kind of approach. And again, the digital generation are looking for something different, in my view. Okay, now, in the original way this flowed in my mind, the next question would be to ask whether today's learning is irrelevant. And obviously not. I mean, it's not irrelevant. People still go to classes. Thousands, millions of people go to classes. But there's an important sense in which we have to weigh carefully just how much impact what we're doing in our schools and universities and colleges is having. And if what I say is somewhat true, then the empirical test of that would be, is there a disassociation between what is being done in colleges and schools and the outcomes of these tests that they're doing to test for outcomes? And when you look at it, there is a disconnect. Two things. There's two studies that I've picked up in particular on my website, and I just didn't have time to get the link for the first one, but it is there. The major determinant of educational achievement, especially in the lower grades in U.S. schools, is nutrition. So, you know, people ask me, gave a talk in Maine not too long ago, and they asked, well, how do you get best quality in e-learning? I said, feed people. And not to be too cynical, but in the United States, this is a controversial issue. If you feed children, they won't be like independent and self-supporting or whatever. It's communism. But really, if you have a serious commitment to educational achievement, feed people. I come here to Australia. I love coming to Australia because everyone's so big and so healthy. People are fed here. And you don't notice this. I notice this. Because I think you're probably doing a bit better a job of it here than we are in Canada. And like, I come to Australia, everyone else is like this. At home, go to the United States. There's a difference, and it's not a genetic difference, it's a nutritional difference. Australia, there was a study just released, you can't see it, there is a link there. Microsoft Word default or PowerPoint default settings. So I read not too long ago that these programs were programmed by otters. And sometimes, well, it was a different context, but the same. Who would make light purple on white the default?
Australian study just released. I covered it in my newsletter just last week, just before I came here, so it's kind of on my mind. Outcomes, school outcomes, almost completely determined by socioeconomic background. Now, that's not an isolated result. I've seen that result elsewhere as well. In Canada, I've seen that result. In the United States, I've seen that result. Social economic background. It was interesting that the same study said, you know, Australia schools are almost completely segregated according to socioeconomic class. And so a little bit later, about 0.5 in the same study, you can predict outcome by schools. Well, duh! Schools are segregated by background. Background is the primary determinant. Therefore, school is a predictor of outcome. But does that give us a mechanism for saying what the school is doing will tell us what the outcome is, as the author is trying to imply? Well, no. Now, we could talk about how this comes to be the case, but it's a link a wee bit, a couple pages down, but they did a big, big study in Britain. Angela McFarland is the person who was the lead author on it. I reported on my public policy research and online learning paper. The idea of the study was to study the impact of computers in the classroom. And they went in, they did this, and they tried to do their best scientific methodology, and they realized that the major determinant of how well the students learned using computers in the classroom was whether they had a computer at home. Because they didn't use them in the schools. They had them, they just didn't, well, they used them. They used them for 1 hour a week. Socioeconomic background. People who have money have computers for other kids. Each kid has a computer. People who are poor don't. They have to go to the library, the reading room. So, you're talking about quality of e-learning. Access. You want people to learn, feed them. But even in the classroom, even with people who have access, even with people who are actually able to learn because their stomachs aren't growing, it's becoming increasingly evident that there's a fundamental disconnect between the way kids think, learn, and communicate, and the ways that schools interact with them. Somebody was asking me during the break, well, how do our traditional institutions with our traditional values cope with this? I mean, what can they do? Well, they could stop being traditional institutions with traditional values. Because what they're doing is something that was designed for a completely different kind of person. Okay, we're now officially caught up. Alright. The MTV mindset. Now, I want to move to where, from where we were to where we want to go with this. I shouldn't wander so much because it'll probably make my voice fade out on the microphone. But there are two major, actually there's about six, seven features. There are two I'll pick up on right now. And what's being called the MTV mindset. I don't like that name, the MTV mindset, because I want it to be, you know, like the Much Music mindset. That just doesn't have the same cachet. First of all, the emphasis on the spatial or the visual. And of course the idea is, you know, you have Much Music video. Video killed the radio star. You have all of these images. There are many, I don't know if people remember when MTV came on the air, there were people who complained and criticized, right? You can't have video with songs. Video takes away all the imagination. But nobody listened to that. And so we have MTV, and we have people with associating spatial and visual imagery with music. It's an interesting thing, if you think about it. The second thing is what is sometimes called multitasking. I don't like that word. Excuse me. Parallel processing. I like that word a bit better to express the same thing, because I'm a connectionist of the old school. Or what we would call multi-threading. Multi-threading is a bit of a technical term. If you've been in a chat room or in a discussion list or something like that, and you follow the conversation doesn't have one topic. You have even just two people. They'll type something in, type something in, type something in. They actually have three or four conversations going on at once. And So I'll type in, how was your vacation? And the other person will type in, I saw the Canadians play last night. And I'll type in, who did they play? And the other person will type in, it was good, but I wanted more time to go to Japan. And I'll type in, they're playing the Bruins next week. Makes no sense, right? But there's different conversations happening all within a single thread. That's multi-threading. But that's what MTV videos do as well. I might be dating myself, Van Halen, which I consider new music, released a video called Right Now, and I still run the tune through my head, and there's all kinds of images flashing and so on, and there's the music. What was really cool about Right Now, if you get a chance to ever see the video, you should, is they put text in there as well, right? Right now, somebody is, right, you know, they're running through the song, you know, right now, somebody is dying, right now, somebody says, incredibly powerful. Now, that's kind of a neat quote. It's sort of periphery, but images, sounds, and this is really important. Images, sounds, and video presented as a single entity. And this is what they're talking about as the MTV mindset. It's not... It's monomedia. It's not multimedia for them. It's a single entity. And these different modalities are coming in as one. They're represented as a single thing. And this is what made the Van Halen song so powerful, because the word, the image, and the sound, that's a single entity. Although, from an analytical point of view, there's three different topics, three different media, three different modalities, but it all becomes one thing. Now, what I think is happening here is that the digital generation is approaching or processing experience in a new way. And what I think is happening is that these multiple inputs in multiple modalities, as I say, are becoming single entities. I have to think about the impact of this, because, right, it's kind of hard to express in this talk. I'm talking to you in words, and I give you a word, and the full and total meaning of what I'm saying to you is contained in the word. But in the new method of multimedia, the MTV generation, the word is only part of the meaning. Now, what does that do when we think about what words mean? Well, the meaning of the word isn't in the word anymore. The meaning of the word is in the music, it's in the imagery, it's in the context, it's all smooshed into one. And it kind of makes a mash of what we think of as traditionally word-based forms of information representation, such as, say, sentential logic or categorization. This whole metadata craze that people are involved in, and I'm involved in it too, is based on a word-based culture. But what's happening here is we're not dealing with words, properly so-called, anymore. Now, this isn't something that simply starts. This isn't something that simply stops. It's something that happens slowly, over a long period of time. 7 days, 24 hours, well, maybe not 24 hours a day, although, I don't know, I leave my TV on at night. I want the information. I may be unconscious, but that doesn't mean I want the TV off. But learning to read, learning to write, higher order cognitive functions. I'm trying to learn French. It's been a year. Well, it took me like 6, 7, 10 years to learn English. I spent a lot of time on it. It's going to take me a little time to learn French, too. But the idea here is that getting these associations together, having words, images, sound be part of one concept, is something that happens after a long process of exposure to these stimuli. And in particular, exposure to MTV, and in our culture, exposure to the internet. It's interesting, there's going to be a bit of a backslide, and we will return as a culture for a short period of time to a more literate, more text-based way of thinking, and that's because as the internet takes over from television, we don't have the bandwidth yet that we want on the internet. A lot of the stuff on the internet is still text-based. So it's going to be a backslide, a happy response to the MTV generation, right? People will be more literate. Educators will rejoice. It's going to be short-lived, though.
I'd just like to sort of question, perhaps challenge you a little bit, to say that perhaps this isn't a new way of learning. It's taking us back to our major way of learning, in that learning through life, we're doing this multi-stimulus receipt all the time. And perhaps even we as trained educators basically say, yeah, most people get their learning through everyday life rather than through the formal word or through the formal training. So perhaps it's not quite so new. Perhaps what we're getting, though, is larger than life, more concentrated and more directed. So it's not a new way of thinking, but we're doing it more concentrated in a better way for the things that we've been doing all along.
Yeah, I think you're right. I'm pretty sure because your voice carries well, I don't need to repeat that, which is fortunate for me, because there was a lot packed into what you said. I think you're absolutely right. I think that the system of learning, and especially the language-based system of learning that we're relying on now, is an artificial situation. It's a recent development. As I'm sure many of you have heard in other discussions, it's something that was brought in with the industrial age. It was brought in with the idea of the mass production of learning. And new technology is giving us a means of liberating ourselves from that. One of the best talks that I did was at networking, the conference. Now you're getting all kinds of plugs, eh? But it was called Online Learning from Virtual to Reality. And you can find that if you search on my website. The point of the talk was that online learning gives us, finally, the opportunity to take learning out of the artificial, sterile environment where it is now and put it back where it belongs in real life. From virtual, the old way, to reality, the new way. Okay. Skip. Well, I'll give you time to read it. All done? Well, what do I want to say? See, I hate doing this. I don't want to talk about this because my time is a little constrained. But I don't want to skip through the slide because you won't have time to read it and then you'll be mad at me. So, okay, good enough. I still want to. Well, because it takes you 15 seconds to read the slide and 5 minutes plus digressions for me to talk about it. Okay. I completely disagree with this theory, but nonetheless, I'll use this as a starting point. The idea proposed by people like Chomsky and Jerry Fodor and others, Zenon Coalition, that there is a thing called the language of thought. And what they're saying is that there is an inherent capacity in the human brain to perform linguistically related tasks. Steven Pinker does talk about the same sort of thing. And I disagree with that because basically the way they depict mental processes is we have everything built in ahead of time, and then the way linguistic capacity realizes itself is that we either use our built-in innate linguistic capacity or the neurons that are involved in this capacity, they're not being used, they atrophy, they die, they go away. And basically the way we are distinct from Chinese people is, as English people, we use one set of linguistic potentiality. Chinese people use a slightly different set of potentiality. I don't think that's right, but I think the general idea is right. And the general idea is that our linguistic capacity is altered by use. And where Folger and Polishin and Chomsky and all of them take what might be called a selectionist model of neural development. I take an instructionist model. That is to say, our linguistic capacity is determined and shaped by experience, and in particular through a process of Hebbian associationism. Donald Hebb is a Canadian neurophysicist who basically propagated, as it turns out correctly, the idea that if two neurons are fired at the same time, over a period of time, these two neurons form an actual physical bond between themselves. They become associated in the mind. I think language develops that way. There is a capacity that we have as a consequence of our genetic structure, but I think that the actual instantiation of this capacity comes through the process of the use of a language, and in particular by exposure to language-type stimuli and then repetition of the stimuli in our own mind. Repetition, echoing, reflection, that sort of thing. There's a good basis for this approach to language development. Now, either way you go, the Chomskyist view or with the associationist view, what constitutes language in our mind is changed by experience. Now, I've just gone through half an hour, whatever, of talking about how our experience today is nothing like the experience people have had in the past, ever. The conclusion, the inevitable, inescapable conclusion is the very concept of language itself is changed. And we are going to have a new language, a post-textual language, a post-language language. I mean this not as a metaphor. I mean this in the most serious, hard-edged, we can look for it and find it kind of thing. This is a little bit of discussion of this idea. It's the idea of left brain, right brain is a nice place to start because a lot of people have heard of it. Technically, it's not exactly right, but it'll do. Now, we have a linguistic capacity, and we have a non-linguistic capacity, a spatial visual capacity. And these things are generally thought of as more or less separate. But when language and visual spatial imagery are presented as part of the same experience and presented over and over and over again, then the traditional separation between the linguistic capacity and the spatial visual capacity, that separation ends. The two capacities are brought together. Language becomes visual. Robert Kellyou instantiates this, although in his case it's kind of a perception. And he's gone around. Robert Kellyou is the person who, with Tim Berners-Lee, created the World Wide Web. And then basically the way it worked, right? Tim Berners-Lee invented the stuff, and Kellyou went around promoting it. And he says, you know, what color is the web? The World Wide Web is green. Because in his mind, because of his particular mental construction, words have colors. And the World Wide Web, for Kellyou, is green. Now, I'm not there. I don't have colors for words, but that's probably because I have lousy eyesight. I do have shapes for songs. You give me a song, I'll tell you what shape it is. It's not in the musical notation or whatever. The songs have shapes. We expect more of this. We can expect this mixing up and cross-categorization. Somebody asked, what is the sign of a digital native? A digital native is somebody who won't put sensory classifications in their place. They'll assign shapes to words, colors to songs, and that all makes sense to them. We think about content. Our typical way of thinking about content, thinking about, say, how a sentence is constructed or whatever, we think about putting things together and adding them up. But when you take the textual content, the visual content, the audio content, perhaps the tactile content, certainly with some of those bass tracks, there's a tactile content. You put them together, it's not organizing them in neat sentences and phrases. It's as it says on the screen there, it's like arranging them. Imagine if he designed your classes this way, right? It's arranging them, stringing together, like a narrative, not like a narrative, but like a painting. Or you don't have, you know, okay, here's some red, here's some blue, here's some red, but you scatter it across the canvas. The content, the semantical meaning is no longer as important. The bits and pieces are no longer as important as the organization of the work that's being presented. I'm talking about evaluating quality of something, the quality of something depends on its relation to other things. Back to the turtle. The old joke, right? You know, that was a beautiful shot, your lordship. It was a wonderful. You took great aim. Your rifleman-ship was spectacular. Thank you, thank you. Too bad it was a horse. Yes, quite. Context. We can't evaluate things outside of context. The multimedia bits and pieces that we are creating aren't set up as words and sentences, chapters in a book. They're set up as grains in a sandcastle, as dabs of paint in an impressionist painting. Here's an example, a simple example. Here's what might be, it was actually used as an example of a learning object. I think Norm Fries and Rory McGrill's one of their talks. And what is this a picture of? That very simple question. We should be able to solve this linguistically, but we can't. Because it depends on the context, where it's used, how it's used. What is this? This is an example of vagueness right now in this talk. People who watched the parade yesterday in Sydney might say something different. Nice parade, by the way. Of course, I think looking at the TV, like in Canada right here, we got, 12 medals in the Olympics. This is a digression. And people are saying, why can't we be more like Australia? And so I'm sitting in the hotel room in Australia. There's 10 channels on TV. 5 of them have sports. There are trade-offs. The message. People should. I had must and I back space and put should because I wanted to, stop thinking of learning as if it was classes and lessons, something like that with built-in intent. Now what are you going to evaluate? Now what counts as quality? It's preferable, and here's the key point, preferable to think of learning resources, the stuff that you guys are producing, as a greatly enhanced vocabulary that is used in what might be called a multimedia or multidimensional language that is being actually spoken and understood today by these digital natives. You probably weren't expecting that when you signed up for this thing. But it's true. And we know it's true. People on the internet, the digital natives today, speak and think quite literally multimedia.
How important is emotion? Because we're getting multimedia from here now. And one thing we're getting, which is more difficult to get over the digital, is emotion. And surely one of the most important things for learning is an emotional involvement, an emotional interrelationship. And that's what perhaps the critics would say one loses if one relies on ones and zeros.
Yeah. Sitting there, over there on the left wing, firing zingers. A lot of the neural stuff that I'm doing is taken out of a book that I've been reading recently called The Synaptic Self. And one of the major theses of this book, and you've seen, I got his name up there, I've forgotten it because I have a very good memory, but it's so very unfortunately short. The three major aspects of self, cognition, emotion, such as fear, is the specialty of the author, and motivation, which is different from emotion. It's an interesting thing, although, you know, my emotion is lethargy, which means there is no motivation. I answer that question something like this, and it's the cynical answer. If there is a motivational problem with a particular class or a particular student, then the problem isn't with the student in question. The problem is in the selection and the presentation of the material that has been given to them to learn. People do things for motivations. They do things, and you know, I could play Maslow hierarchy and start talking about whether you feed yourself, house yourself, you know, so on and so forth. But we don't even need to get into that sort of level of detail. People have things that they are interested in. In my talk, my previous talk in Utah, I talked about their culture, their values, their community, their lives. These are the things that touch them. Actually, it wasn't in that talk. It was the article on blogging. If motivation and indeed emotion are a problem, it's because there is a separation. It may be because there is in part a separation between what they are being taught and what they live. And let me stop with that sentence for now, but we'll keep that sentence in mind because I got a couple of slides that will sort of deal with that over the next little bit. Is that all right? She's going to say no. How am I going on time, please? Another 2 hours. All right. So anyhow, as I'm writing this thing this morning, I'm standing out on the balcony of my hotel and a bus goes by, music, the internet, and even TV, all on a fridge. And the bus gets it. Now, I could go into a long talk about this, but I won't. But like, cognition works, and we know this. This is not me making up neuroscience on the fly. That wouldn't stop me. But we know this. People's experiences, what they see when they see something, what they read when they read something, are shaped from two things. And the one thing is the set of perceptions, the set of perceptual experiences that are actually coming in. There's a whole process. But the other thing is the environment into which those perceptions come. Their memories, their previous experiences, their conceptual awareness. One of the most vivid and disturbing episodes of my life happened about a year and a half ago. And those of you who are long-term readers of my newsletter will remember this. My cat died. It was sad. I'd had my cat for 17 years. But what was really disturbing, my cat died because she had a brain tumor. And the brain tumor was kind of up like here. And it actually was pushing into her breathing. I'm not going to get into this. It's very sad. But there was a noticeable bump on her head from the brain tumor. I did not see that bump. Quite literally, did not see the bump. My cat. I love my cat. I care for my cat. I've had my cat for 17 years. I would do anything for my cat. She was sick, and I finally took her into the vet. I said, what can you do for her? Well, she had a brain tumor. I said, brain tumor? Look at the lump on her head. I had never seen the lump on her head until the vet said, there's a lump on her head. we form models, pictures in our mind of what the world is, what we expect the world to be. And these are based on a variety of things. There's some innate, the freeze reaction in the case of fear, for example. When an explosion goes off, people go, that's innate. That's part of our mental picture. A lot of it built up from experience. And the sort of picture that's being built today is this multimedia mishmash kind of picture. Remember, this is where people today, students today, are getting most of their information, is in this multimedia environment. And that's the filter through which they are seeing everything. For knowledge to stick, they have to have experiences that can relate, that can be connected to, can be tied into these conceptions that they have previously had. Our new learning, for it to work, has to be in the new language that students speak. One of the major characteristics, I'll pull two big differences out of another set a little bit later. The old language is a transmissive language. You speak, or you write, somebody reads, somebody listens. See, he left his paper there, so I know he's coming back. That's a big difference. It's the difference between being a viewer and being part of the program. It's the difference between being a reader and being in an interactive environment. It's the difference between journalism and blogging. The other difference, second difference, the difference between description and experience. In the textual world, we try to make do with description. We try to make do with this artificial, quasi-artificial system of words that represent phenomena in the world, but aren't those phenomena and are distinct from it. It's the old idea, you know, you just couldn't put it into words, or you had to be there. You know, words are artificial, but the new form of the language is the experience itself. And if you ever read Philip Rushkoff, dang, I hate it when my memory blanks out like that, especially when I'm giving a talk. I think it's Philip Rushkoff, wrote a book called Siberia. There's the idea of the new generation not having just these different cognitive capacities, but also wanting to immerse themselves in experience, to experience things for themselves, to try many things. To as he said, Douglas Rushkoff. To surf the wave, if you will. I highly recommend Rushkoff. He's a writer who has studied and looked at and gets this digital generation. Pardon? You're asking me to spell? And haven't you read my website? Rushkoff, plus or minus a letter. The old language, objects are placed in a sequence with maybe limited branching. Sound familiar? Static, need for uniformity. Words have one meaning. Single focus, what is the topic of your essay? The new language, objects are placed in an environment. If I was giving this talk in new multimedia speak, I'd have various images coming off the wall. I might have some lasers on the ceiling. I'd definitely have a soundtrack. I'd have three or four screens up there. You would have wireless access. You'd have your laptops or your PDAs. There would be a conversation going out here. I see it here. I'd be responding to the conversations here. I'd be talking about that image there. Somebody over there would be doing something themselves. It would be a multimodal, multimedia, immersive experience. That's what learning would look like in this new kind of environment. And I know that that's what learning would look like, because if you go into a rave club or any environment like that, that's what you see. we're moving from linear to multi-threaded, from content delivery to immersive and interactive environments, from something that's static and paced to something that's dynamic and unpaced, from demonstration to inference, and I don't like that word. I mean something other than inference by the word inference. And based on what I've just said, I can get away with that. From learning objectives, you're probably expecting quality in e-learning. Well, it has to have objectives. And in the purest behaviorist sense, the objectives ought to have the right verbs in them, right? Never mind that the objectives of the learning object might have nothing to do with what the learner wanted the object in the first place. We move from objective to learner goals, from motivation to desire. And we come back to the emotion aspect of it. It's no longer a case of getting people motivated. It's a case of recognizing, understanding, and fulfilling the desire that the student already has for whatever it is that they are trying to learn. Now I go into the section on learning environments. Now, I'm not sure how much I want to talk about learning environments here because I have a limited amount of time, and there's this bit and then the other bit about quality that I really want to get back to because that, after all, was the topic of my presentation. But the idea of learning environments is that instead of creating a course in which you're going to present materials, the idea is that you create, or better yet, find an environment where access to learning objects or learning resource becomes a feature of the environment. And you might think, how strange, how could you do that? Access to reading is a feature of the environment. It's here. If I need to read, it's right here. Mostly I won't need it. But should I need to learn how to play a video from computer VCR, there it is. Part of the environment. Learning should be like that. We're already beginning to see various types of environments online, multi-threaded streams of discourse such as blogs, interactive knowledge bases such as wikis. If you don't know what a wiki is, do a Google search on wiki and you get all kinds of stuff. There's a great article by Brian Lamb in the current EDUCAUSE review introducing wikis. Embedded learning, Jay Cross talks about, what did he talk about? Workplace learning. I don't like that phrase, but the idea of embedding learning right in with the environment where you're performing tasks. I'm just going to skip this. I'm sorry, I really hate doing that. But I'm not going to skip this. Again, I was doing my research, and I thought I was so proud of myself. I'm in the Diamond Cafe, and I'm right next to the Department of Education, Science, and Training, or something like that. It's new to me still. I thought, great, I'm right in the right place to be reading about all of this stuff. I'm putting myself in the context. And here's the article. Person in Melbourne, film director, producer, something like that, in Melbourne, called Kirsty Baird, created is trying to work with people who live on the street, and to reach them, has created a game called Street Survivor. And the idea of this game is that it mirrors the experiences of homeless young people. I don't like the word youngsters, but it was in the article I put it in here. It's neat. There's a drug in the game called Quick, which I thought was a stroke of genius. I love that name. I can just imagine. I haven't seen the game, because I only read about it a few hours ago. Players manage their health, their habit, their self-esteem. But the neat thing here is that the game is connected to the real world. In the game, you can get health points or esteem points by accessing the food bus, or you can get free food. And the location of the food bus in the game corresponds to the location of the food bus in Melbourne, in real life. I think that's getting it. The learning is in an environment, and the environment meshes, is drawn from, is part of the student's experiences. And this also gives me, and this is a wee bit of an aside, but I want to bring this out, because I'm known by a lot of people for talking about learning objects, and reusable learning objects, and all of that. And people are really tied themselves up into knots about learning objects. This gives me a context to really draw that out, because we have this game, and we have these features, the location of these buses, and it's coded into this game. And I'm sitting there thinking, well, what if people in Sydney want to use this game? Well, all the buses are located in Melbourne. What are the homeless people in Sydney going to do when the buses are in Melbourne? They're not going to travel to Melbourne just to get to a food bus. And there'll be this disconnect here between the game and the people taking the game. Or what happens in Melbourne if they change the location of the food bus? Because they do that. It's just like a little trick they play on homeless people. You have to find the food bus. You think I'm kidding? We have a food bus in Moncton. You know, every 3 or 4 months they change the locations just to see if you're in the know. Now, one of the bits of data in this game is the location of the food bus. This bit of data, the location of the food bus, is a learning object. And the way it should work is this game should obtain this learning object, this piece of information, on a dynamic, real-time basis from what we will call a learning object repository. The designer of the game should be able to say, put in this place, location of food bus, Melbourne, or whatever. Or location of food bus, home city of student. And that information should then be fed dynamically into this learning environment. That's what I mean by putting learning content into a learning environment. Now, in this case, it's simply location of food bus. But it can be any bit of content or learning or information that you want to put into this. And when I talk about things like XML and RSS and syndication and topic-based filtering and all the stuff that I'm talking about tomorrow, all I'm talking about are the mechanisms, the computational mechanisms for getting the correct location of a food bus into a game that has a food bus. That's all I'm talking about. The question you should be asking is, how do you judge the quality of something like the location of a food bus? Because that's what our learning content has become. Okay. The theory. I've stolen this from Jukes, and I don't even know how to pronounce that. Dosa. Did any of you find my wiki about this talk? I didn't advertise it. Probably should have. One person. I mentioned it in my newsletter. There is a wiki page on my website devoted to this talk. If you go to my website and look at the top right-hand side, and there's a little button that says Wiki. Click on that button, you'll see a thing that says Australia. Click on that button, you'll find the Wiki page for this talk. This reference is on that page, which is why I mentioned it. Sorry, it's kind of convoluted. My website isn't nicely linear organized the way it should be yet. Anyhow, effective learners... Now, why is that sentence there? Never mind. The point here is, and I said this already, the students have the mental model. The mental model, crucially, critically, is in their language, is based in, rooted in, their own lives, their own experience. It therefore follows that this model is unique to the person, and therefore there's no single mental model that we can appeal to when we're trying to talk about learning resources. And that this mental model is intimately involved in the comprehension, evaluation, processing, if you will, of learning resources. So, with 3 minutes left, he says, hoping that he has 3 minutes, back to quality. The first thing I'm not sure about anymore, but I'll go with it. Describe resources using metadata. What I mean today when I say that is come up with a mechanism whereby resources can be described, probably involving some form of metadata. And there are reasons why I would phrase it like that, because as I've thought about this, the idea that we would take a resource and assign a librarian to fill in 87 or whatever metadata tags becomes more and more ludicrous, particularly when we think about hundreds of millions of learning objects, the nature of which changes on a dynamic day-to-day basis. So describe learning resources using metadata. There's a lot packed into that, but I'm not going to get into a whole lot. The point is, get this information. Integrate into this what we will call a learning object or a learning resource evaluation metadata format, and then use evaluation results in the search process. Now, what that is a magical sleight of hand, right? Okay. When we think about evaluating and what this evaluation metadata is going to be, we need to be thinking about the sorts of questions that we need to be asking. Are we evaluating the right thing? You get evaluations of courses and classes. To me, it makes no sense. Why would we bother? Once a course is done, it's done. Yeah, you might use the same resources next time. It would be a brand new course, right? This is one of these, you know, things about personal identity that philosophers think about all the time. It's not the same course the second time you teach it. What we should be evaluating are people, resources, smaller grain things, things that are actually part of the learning environment. Skipping. The principle of quality. Unless you're going to get some of the content you expected in this talk. The principle of quality that the system is based on is something is good because in the past, people like you expressed satisfaction with things like this. Now, this is not a metric. This is not a set of best practices. And it's not that because there isn't some universal set of qualities that you can say make something good or bad. Because if you think about it, think about what we've talked about so far. The individual, you know, the way a person looks at or uses a resource is irreducibly individual. The quality or usefulness of a resource depends on the context in which it's applied. And the resource itself isn't even something that we can describe in the typical the typical text-based language way that we talk about things. That was badly phrased. Basically, therefore, our system of evaluation of learning resources cannot be based on the inherent properties of the resource, but rather the resource in relation to its context of use and the person of using it. The person who is using it. So we're not going to get a nice, neat metric of quality. People hate stuff like that because it's soft, it's fuzzy. How could it work? Well, people have been working, moving along these lines. There's been previous work done in quality and the various dimensions of quality of learning resources. I've just briefly mentioned some stuff here. The links, of course, you still can't see them because I know I don't have any time. It's been bugging me for this whole talk. There's no reason to. Of course, now the links are there. You look at the percentage signs, and it's probably better off when they were. Anyhow, again, this slideshow will be on my website, and you'd be able to just click on the link and go to these pages. Now, a lot of the work that we've done, that has been done, with respect to the evaluation of quality of learning resources has been much like the model in Merleau. Now, Merleau uses the time-tested model of peer review of learning resources. And after, I don't know, 5 years and how many volunteer hours and so on, they've evaluated something like 800, 900 objects. They'll need to evaluate a million or so this year. It's not going to work. Peer review won't work. I want you to think about that. Because if you're looking at anything like peer review, anything like a review process where experts look at learning content and decide whether or not it's good enough to pass along to students, it won't work. Because there is too much content, too many objects, not enough reviewers. Even if it did work, all you would have is the assessment from the point of view of the assessor, which may or may not be the point of view of the learner. Imagine if we rated music that way, and what would be considered good would be whatever the reviewer thought was good. And students would have to listen to whatever the reviewer thought was good. It wouldn't make sense. Well, it would make sense, it wouldn't be very fun. Okay, so what we need is a mechanism. Remember, this is a dynamic, real-time, information-anywhere system. We need to have an evaluation of the object, a good evaluation of the object, before the object has ever been seen or used by anyone, much less a reviewer. We need a system that will not only conduct this kind of evaluation, but then be able to propagate the results of the evaluation. Remember, nobody's seen this object yet, this learning resource yet. Propagate it in such a way that people can find it. Thus we get the magical sleight of hand that's known in the online community as recommender systems. And what a recommender system does is it allows people who are using resources, such as learning objects, to in some way evaluate them. There are different ways of evaluating a resource. One way is simply by using it. Another way, a very important way, is by passing it on, the feed-forward part of the metric that I described. This is the metric that Google uses. Google ranks web pages, has a technology called PageRank. And the way Google ranks objects, ranks web pages, is according to a system based on the number of pages that link to that particular page. So my homepage, Stephen Downs, is the top ranked page for Downs on Google. That means if you just type Downs into Google, you'll get my homepage on top. And the way that comes to be is more pages referring to Downs refer to my page than to anybody else's. And this is significant because there is, in Melbourne, which I'm not visiting on this trip, a restaurant critic called Stephen Downs, who has a significant web presence. And I've been tooth and nail with him for many years. I'm happy to report that I'm winning.
Stephen, we can help you win by a thing known as Google
Bombing. Yes, you can. And even Google, of course, is aware of Google Bombing, which is, of course, the production of superfluous links to a web page simply to improve one's Google rank. So what Google does is it actually ranks the pages linking to the pages that is being ranked, so that what you actually get is a qualified ranking system. The recommender system kind of works like that too, because if I'm looking for a learning resource, I don't want the resource that everybody else liked, because I'm not like everybody else. I want the resource that people like me liked. Now that might be a pretty small group of people. Some would say one. But in which case, that's not so good. But the idea is that the ranking of a quality of a resource is based on the properties of the user as well as the properties of the resource itself. And now, what if the object doesn't exist yet? I can know where the thing should be ranked based on its similarity with other objects that have been ranked. So you look at the range of different properties of an object. Take an image. What kind of image is it? What's its color ratio? Color ratio? That's not what I meant. Color depth, aspect ratio. What's the content of this image? Where has this image been used before? By what people? How many times? And you take this image and you compare those properties with the new image. And if the new image is sufficiently similar to the old image, and if the old image was really popular for people like me, then you can predict through a standard process of induction that the new image will probably be pretty popular with people like me, and therefore me. And that's the hard recommender systems. This is not new technology. There was a system that came out 95, 96 called Firefly. Fantastic. Disappeared because Microsoft bought it and destroyed it to create the passport. What Firefly did, you created a user profile. That's the passport part, right? That's all Microsoft was interested in. And you used your user profile and you'd rate books and books and music and things like that. And then Firefly would recommend books or music that you might like based on the preferences of other people like you. Way ahead of its time. Couldn't possibly survive. Launch exists now. You'll find Launch at Yahoo. And it allows people to rate and recommend music. Beautiful interface. Love the interface. The problem, and it proposes new music to you. The problem with Launch is its very commercial orientation. It's constantly recommending songs off the top 10 hype list, whether they fit your profile or not. So, you know, I've got, you know, like folk, new country, you know, Dylan, 70s, because that's where music was perfect. And I'm listening to the music on Launch, and every 10th song is rap. Why? Why? I don't want to listen to Eminem. Match.com, very similar sort of thing, except instead of ranking books or music or whatever, you rank people. Why not? People are resources. Well, that's not the way Match looks at them. I didn't say that in the context of talking about Match, but basically it's a dating service, and it's a recommender service. So you enter in all the profile stuff, and then it'll recommend people. I tried it out. Tried to enter in all my profile stuff, and it rejected me. These things are not perfect. So, evaluating learning, therefore, becomes coming up with a way of describing learning resources. And in fact, when I talk about this in more detail, I changed the order of the slides when I was putting this together, and now I realize that was a bad plan. Talk about different ways of evaluating things. I'm not going to give you the final way of describing learning resources, because there is and will never be a final way of describing learning resources. There is not going to be, as I have said in previous talks, one metadata language for all. Different things. Resources are metadata descriptions created by the author of the learning object. Metadata created by the user of the learning resource. This includes things like the context of use. This includes things like a 1-to-5 rating that the person might use. This includes things like any sort of data about or by the user that can be used to describe the learning resource. I want this to be all automatic. I want our e-learning systems to know when we used an object, when we used a resource, and in what context. And then finally, resources described by third parties when and where necessary. I must be over my time because I'm losing people, and I'm sure it's not my fault. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to skip because I know people are leaving, and I know that they don't want to do that. Learning resource filtering. All right. The quality of a learning resource is directly related to its meaningfulness. Its meaningfulness is how the resource connects to the learner in the sense of the models and the vocabulary that I've been talking about throughout this talk. It's similar, if pressed, I would say, to Terry Anderson's concept of presence in learning, in e-learning. And if you're not familiar with that, look up Terry Anderson, because he's well known for this. The meaningfulness, or the meaning, following Wittgenstein, is the use of the object. If the object is used, then it is quality. Or taking that more generally, if objects like this are used by people like that, in that kind of circumstances, then it's quality. So, is that really the finale? Do you want to know? Yes. I don't know if you had a chance to read that. So that basically, I'm sorry I went over time. I really didn't want to, but thank you very much for taking the time and in some cases the travel to come and hear me talk. I really appreciate it. And that's it.
No, won't you? I'm sorry. You have a burning question that you won't be...